The Buckmaster Radio Program is paid for by Buckmaster Communications, LLC. The views expressed are not necessarily those of KVOI, Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or their sponsors.
Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy John. Together, we welcome you. A big hearty welcome to the Buckmaster Show. Midweek edition. It's Wednesday. It is April the 12th. 2023, our program in its 13th year, broadcasting from the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studio, part of the Bustos Media Complex here in Tucson. The radio station 1030 KVOI, Tucson's voice for trusted news and talk. We have our worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. We piggyback the live feed from kvoi.com. For our telephone interviews, the Buckmaster Live Line is presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. Each day, there are more than 45,000 flights in the United States in national airspace. In recent months, planes came unnervingly close on runways in New York, Texas, Boston, Honolulu, Hawaii, Florida, Virginia, outside Washington, D.C. And I think the closest of the near misses, this one was really scary. A FedEx plane back in February landing at the International Airport in Austin, Texas, came within 100 feet of a Southwest Airlines jet taking off on the same runway. Both planes were given clearance from air traffic control to use that runway. Let's welcome now back to the Buckmaster Show our contributor on aviation, JetBlue Captain Jeff Lattis, who recently retired after 20 years with the airline, where he flew nearly 20,000 hours of accident-free aviation, commanding the Airbus A320 and the Airbus A321. Jeff is a highly decorated retired combat fighter pilot. He's now into the next chapter of his career, which involves the Bombardier Challenger series of business jets. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Bill.
So how's this?
I can finally get on.
Well, I know you're incredibly busy right now with this the training you're going through on the Challenger. Before we talk about near misses, how's that going for you? You've now a couple of months into it. What's the latest?
Well, you know, it's a long process, so I am kind of wrapping up chapter one of at least two or three chapters here. So, you know, and it's definitely a different mentality of flying, and so that's what the process really is all about, is just learning a new airplane and the type of business it gets into. So that's where I'm at now.
Is this the new series of Challengers? I think it's the 350. Is that right?
No, it's actually the 600 series.
Oh, I'm a little behind there. Okay. Do they? I know Bombardier has had a presence here in Tucson. Do they still manufacture aircraft here?
You know, I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
This used to be their final assembly.
Yeah.
So this is where they would put the cabins in and
yeah,
things like that. I'm not too sure if they're doing that now. I know they kind of downsized here a while back. So I wish I could tell you.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about what the FAA calls an uptick in close calls. Of course, close calls, you well know, you and your colleagues in the industry, they are part of, unfortunately, they're a part of aviation, but this uptick seems to be a little bit more concerning. Would you agree?
Oh, definitely. It's definitely a trend that was highly exaggerated in a technical sense, that they, and there still seems to be no real understanding of why there's been such an increase in this incident rate. So I will tell you that it's on every pilot's mind right now, and I guarantee you every company is making sure that all their crew members are much more aware of their situational awareness on runways and what's going on around them. So that's going to be an emphasis item, if not for this next year, probably for the few years coming, that pilots will be trained to be on the guard for this when they go for their annual training. I'm sure there's going to be not only classroom discussion on this, but also some simulator training on it as well.
The FAA put together a summit fairly recently to try to talk about, well, and maybe explore concrete, I don't know if there is such a thing, concrete actions to kind of enhance the country's safety net. What do you think could be done to maybe enhance that safety?
Well, kind of what I just stated. A lot of it's going to be in the training world. Just recognizing and understanding some of it has been not being aware of where you are on the taxiways. That was the case with the American 777 and the Delta 737 at JFK. It was obvious that the pilots in the American flight thought they were someplace else and crossed the wrong runway. They were cleared to cross another runway, for instance. It's not just pilots, it's air traffic controllers, as you were saying in your intro, where the FedEx jet almost landed on top of a Southwest jet. Now, there was some pilot issues with that as well, but the controllers basically cleared the guy to land and also cleared a guy to take off. And that's a controller issue. The Southwest pilot didn't help any things out. He was told there was an airplane on short final, and they kind of took their time taking off. The controller should have told the FedEx airplane to go around and was very slow in doing so. The one in Boston, which was a Learjet taking off in front of a landing JetBlue flight, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
It was crossing runway. The Learjet was taking off on one runway, and then JetBlue was landing on another. They just missed, thought they had takeoff clearance when they didn't, the Learjet, and took off in front of the, as the JetBlue plane was landing. That's a pilot error. What I've been hearing in the media is it's a COVID thing. Pilots are just getting back in the saddle. I kind of disagree with that. Pilots have been working their behinds off in the last couple of years. And you know that. You travel a lot.
Yeah.
You've been seeing how airports are.
Of course.
So I think that it's kind of the opposite side of the spectrum, and you're starting to see kind of burnout in a way where pilots are not necessarily fatigued, but they're getting tired. They need some time off. And the way the industry is set up, it's difficult to do. So hopefully that gets addressed if that is the problem. I mean, I'm kind of making a little bit of an assumption here, just based on my last couple of years of flying, that I was working pretty hard. It wasn't a fact that I'd been off forever and came back to fly.
Yeah.
So
let's go to our live line. Matt has called us. Matt has a question or comment for Jeff Lattice. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, Jeff. I don't know if you remember this, or maybe Bill does too, but a few years back, and this might, you know, definitely before COVID, there was a change in how the routes of the planes would approach the airport. And the reason that it was a big deal was Phoenix was the test, was one of the test locations for it. And Sky Harbor, there was a big question. There was a big, you know, discussion amongst the public and as to how the planes would be approaching Phoenix based off the new system and the new way they brought the planes from one hub city to another hub city and so forth. Do you remember anything about that? Because I wonder if in some way we're feeling, you know, the ultimate effects of that, you know, massive change in how air traffic moves around the country.
Okay, thank you, Matt.
Well, I do remember that to a certain degree, but it was typically for just a pattern deconfliction. This happens all the time at a lot of the busy airports. They'll change the arrival routing. When you're coming into an airport that's busy like Phoenix or L.A. or San Francisco, there's an arrival routing that you have to take. That route is defined by fixes and altitudes at those fixes. And eventually the controllers usually start giving you radar vectors. But those are primarily designed to deconflict arrival traffic from departure traffic. If there's another airport in the vicinity, they try to keep airplanes away from being a conflict in those areas. I think if I remember right, a lot of the complaints were like, not necessarily noise complaints, but people started noticing the airplanes were flying over their head when they didn't used to.
Mm-hmm.
But that happens a lot. And a lot of that comes from where they might have some kind of conflict, and they go back in, the FAA will go back in there and redesign these routes. Like I said, that happens every couple of years or so.
All right. Jeff, stay with us. I want to talk a little bit about staffing issues. Southwest is cutting the training for the pilots. I think their training time is going to be cut in half. But anyway, we're going to pick up more with Jeff Lattice, retired JetBlue pilot, after we tell people about Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. If you're looking for something sweet and delicious from the bakery case, get there early. They open at 6:30 Tuesday through Saturday. I'm usually around there Sunday mornings when they I'm not there necessarily open when they open at 7, but I will be there probably mid-morning, and my advice is get there early because you'll have the best selection up at Mona's. They're open right now for lunch, northeast corner, Swan and Sunrise. The website's monasdanishbakery.com. We're talking aviation with Jeff Lattice. More with Jeff right after this. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
This is Kate Delaney. Tune in later tonight as we talk about everything that happened throughout your day. Tonight at 10 on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Thing, Zocalo Village Studio. We continue our conversation talking aviation, one of my favorite subjects. I love to travel, love to fly. I'm talking to the right guy, JetBlue retired Captain Jeff Lattice. Mandatoried out at 65. He had to leave. That's the rule for commercial pilots. Jeff turned 65 and he had to give up commercial airline flying, but he's now involved with Bombardier, the Bombardier Challenger series of business jets. He's learning all about those. Jeff, does the quality, and you know I love to travel, I've been to, you know, whenever they put out those lists of the 10 scariest airports to land at, I've hit a few of them, and three or four are in the Caribbean, and I've hit all three of the ones in the Caribbean: St. Bart's, the island of Saba, where pilots have to be specially trained to land there. And so there are some really tricky airports, and I wondered, we've been talking about near misses, does the quality... And I know you did the Caribbean a lot. Does the quality vary from international destination to international destination?
Okay, the music was going a little loud there. What I think I heard you ask was, you know, is there different training for, like, foreign destinations?
My question was, I had hit some of those scary airports, some of those places that are... You know, St. Bart's, the Dutch West Indies airline of Saba, where pilots have to be specially trained to land on that island. I mean, it's it must be like landing on an aircraft carrier is basically what it's like.
Yeah, so I have to admit, I haven't had the opportunity to land at like St. Bart's, which I know how the airplanes come in there, and I know Saba is like a little... runway on the side of the mountain
it is.
There.
And St. Bart's is basically over the mountain, and the runway is at the base of the mountain. So
And then there's a road that goes right by there. So
yes, there is.
The wheels of the airplane are like feet above the cars.
Yeah, and I've also landed on one of the 10 scariest on the island of Madeira, the Portuguese island, which is the crosswinds there are so incredible that it's very, very, very difficult to land on that island. But my question to you, and I know you've flown all over the Caribbean, when you're landing at some of these airports, we were talking about near misses in the United States, the procedures, are they different from air traffic controller to air traffic controller in these different islands?
They are pretty much the same. You know, obviously, they're going to fall under different regulations for the countries they fall under. But pretty much, most of the procedures are the same worldwide on those types of issues, like runway incursions and distances between airplanes and things like that. So, yeah, I would say I wouldn't feel any different going to a Caribbean island as I would going into Chicago O'Hare.
It's a little prettier when you land, though, than it is at Chicago O'Hare. Jeff, let me ask you about this situation with training. There is a need to get accelerate the hiring process in your industry. Southwest is reducing by half the amount of experience prospective pilots must have on flying jets or turboprop aircraft. Okay. Are we going to see more of that?
Probably. I haven't seen this article, but everybody's having most companies, especially the major airlines, are going to set some kind of minimum that you need so much time in jet aircraft, pilot in command, even turbine type airplanes, and weight is another big thing, how big of the airplane you flew. They're already reducing that. As a matter of fact, there are some airlines out there that are hiring people who can. The minimum qualification in the airline world is 100 or 1,500 hours, and you have to have what's known as an ATP, which is a airline transport pilot license. And some people, they get that, and they get put right into a major jet, and they don't have hardly any time flying complex airplanes. So that's going to be the nature of the beast, just because there's all these old guys like me that had to leave the force because of the age 65 rule.
Yeah, the Air Force, and of course you know the Air Force, you're a former Air Force veteran combat pilot, they're saying their shortfall. They've got nearly 2,000 pilots, a shortfall of nearly 2,000 pilots, Jeff, at the end of this September.
Yeah, you know, if you're a youngster and you have a passion for flying and you're wanting to start your career in flying, you can't find a better time than right now. Anybody out there that's listening that might have kids or something that, you know, in high school that are interested in becoming pilots, start seeking out how they do it. And it's a great opportunity. It's hard to keep people in the regional airlines, you know, the smaller airliners. Those are usually younger people that are flying those airplanes, and they're going to the major airlines. So there's definitely a stepping stone, and there's a door that's wide open for anybody. Even in the business that I'm in now, in the corporate world, they're having trouble keeping people. So, it's a good time to be a pilot, especially if you're a younger pilot.
Where'd you learn to fly? I know you're from Wichita. Did somebody take you up on in a Piper Cub or something?
I had a friend of mine whose father rebuilt airplanes that got damaged in storms. And on a dirt strip, and we'd go out flying. But actually, I didn't really start flying until right before I went in the Air Force in ROTC. And that was like 25 hours. I got right here in Tucson. And then I went off to pilot training, and I flew jets. It's kind of one of my bragging rights. I only have 35 hours of prop time out of 20,000.
Wow.
Because I've been flying jets ever since. It was kind of a good time back then, too, when I entered. It was the early 80s, and there was a need for pilots back then, too. And my timing was exceptional. And so that's kind of where my pilot training came from. So, and here I am.
Let me ask you, Jeff, and I know you're following the Ukraine war, which is stalemated. It seems like it's something out of World War II, the Eastern Front, a trench warfare. You don't hear a lot about the air war in the Ukraine. I know you're following that. Is there much of an air war?
It's increasing. There's a lot of helicopter flying, and there's a need to get the Ukrainians possibly more modern air, helicopters in particular. I read an article that there were Ukrainians right here in Tucson yep. That were actually checking out in the F-16. The guard unit here is a training unit, and they were assessing, you know, I guess their ability to learn and how fast they can learn to fly that airplane. So Obviously, a lot of that stuff is going to be confidential at minimum. Looks like the writing's on the wall that eventually the Ukrainians will be supplied with fairly modern airplanes, whether they're from the old Soviet bloc, you know, from Poland and East Germany, the old East Germany, who still had MiG-29s, but possibly some of F-16s.
You know, Jeff, I was just going to wrap this up with you. I've only got a few seconds, but getting back to our lead topic with you, Jeff Lattice, about the near misses. You know, here at a stoplight, when the light turns green in this town, I count almost to five, 1/1,000 before I proceed into the intersection. And maybe it's going to be that way. You got your clearance to go. The controller has given you the clearance on the runway. Probably a good idea to just do a bunch of visual checks real quick.
Yeah, I mean, that is a requirement. Before you take the runway, you are supposed to make sure nobody's on final. And, you know, there's two people there. You confirm it with your other co-pilot or with the captain, you know, that, hey, we're cleared for takeoff, or are we cleared for, you know, just to hold on the runway.
Right.
You have to confirm which runway you're on.
Yeah.
So all that gets done before you actually start rolling forward to take the active runway. So,
all right.
And there are, believe it or not, some kind of a stoplight system in the major airports.
Okay. Jeff Lattice, got to go. Always a pleasure. Good luck with your continued training. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Bill. Fine. Glad.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. And your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. Green Things, 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park 13-acre site, ready with, well, the plants are waiting. They are waiting to be planted in your garden. Spring color at Green Things, greenthingsaz.com, and zocalovillage.com. Their sister business. They are open daily. They're in their 53rd year of business. Our live line presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. Let's go now on the live line for our monthly visit with Tucson City Councilman Paul Cunningham. Councilman, how are you?
Doing very well. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for asking. We have the ballots ready to be sent to voters for the May election, a special election. This has to do with Tucson Electric rate hikes for underground lines. That's going to the voters. How are you advocating one way or another, or are you even is that permissible?
I'm supporting it. I'm supporting it right now. I mean, the bottom line is I ask for three things, and very specifically. One is to be able to enhance how often we do undergrounding, to allow future undergrounding, allows us to work with our corridors and some other things. So they met that. The other one that I asked for was I wanted solar co-ops to be facilitated a little bit. I mean, we need some help from the state government and some laws there, but basically I wanted HOAs and neighborhood associations to be able to purchase or enter into solar agreements in bulk. And they met those two wishes very, very specifically. Do I really think that we should have, I've talked to you about this before. Do I think that the private model is the best model? Probably not. But the amount of cost and the amount of work that it would take to separate our community from the franchise agreement is probably a long process. It'll take us about 20 years to do it, and we can start working on it now. It's nothing we can do it in about a decade, maybe. But in the meantime, TEP is what we've got, and to be honest with you, there are worse partners we could have. So I'm happy to help TEP with their quests right now. Maybe we can get something good things out of it, like better undergrounding laws that we didn't have before, and a better proliferation of solar energy. And I think those were the things that I asked for, and they delivered.
Okay, so if it doesn't pass, what happens?
They'll have to draft up another franchise agreement and go back out to the voters. And here's the thing. They've got three or four years and three or four chances to do that. And I don't know whether or not if it keeps getting voted down, all that happens is our existing franchise agreement continues. So it's just not that great a law in the first place. We're kind of stuck. And so if it was on a perfect world, I'd want to have like a 25-year plan to pay back their infrastructure costs and figure out a way that it could be a municipally owned utility. But I don't know if that's going to be really tough, considering that TEP serves multiple jurisdictions. So we'll probably be kind of like the model that APS has in Maricopa County someday, which is not the most exciting thing, but I will say that I feel TEP right now, with the people that they have there, do a better job in at least trying to communicate with our community and at least hearing what we're asking.
All right. My next item on my stack of stuff that I have for you, a lot going on with the city. Tucson is pursuing some partnerships to keep the transit fares free. What are the prospects of Pima and the University of Arizona kind of pitching in to share the burden with the city of Tucson to keep transit free in this city?
I think it's going to be a longer process than we think. I think that without any leverage, it's very hard to go into a negotiation point and say, well, you're already getting this for free, but please give us some money so we can keep it free for everybody else. That's a tough thing to say, but we think there's a way to do it. I'm actually kind of optimistic that we may get to that point. I think there's a couple opportunities that we have, and ultimately I think that we'll have a package that will kind of meet everyone's needs. That's what I'm hoping for, but it's really early. My hard ground was it was pretty obvious that we weren't going to go back to the days of the $82 express monthly fare, and we weren't going to go back to the $25 a month low-income fare. I just don't know. I don't see that happening. The other thing is that if we lower it at a certain point, there's a point where it actually costs more to collect the money. So we've got to figure out, what those pieces are. I think it'll be a conversation that goes on for a while. It's really hard to, I have some people advocating to bring fares back. I just don't have a lot of people who ride the bus, who actually ride the bus, advocating to bring fares back. So that's a tough one that's a tough one to swallow. And then you have some other kind of nuances in that discussion. So we really have to kind of start focusing on, all right, how do we make our transit system the transit system we envision that has the efficiency? Probably the biggest piece that I'm coming in on this item is actually the Sunband piece. One of the things that we have is paratransit, which is Sunband. And it is the forgotten, it's like the forgotten child of the transit system. Paratransit is so important. And we have a situation where some of our best operators are in the Sunband system. They take extra training on how to work with folks who use paratransit. They know a lot of their riders by name. They're just some outstanding people, but they are so short-staffed. The other piece is we literally have paratransit customers saying, hey, look, it's great that it's free and we appreciate that, but we'd actually pay a little extra if our wait times and commute times could be reduced. So we have this kind of piece. And what's crazy is it's related to the SunTran piece. We cannot buy the limitations that are included in our federal grant that provides a chunk of our funding for transit. We can't use that. We can't have fares in paratransit if we don't have fares in SunTran. And so that's kind of the more complicated piece for me, is trying to find a way so that we can keep that well-priced paratransit function, but still have an enhanced function so that paratransit users can at least experience at some level the Uber pleasure that you and I have. We can take an Uber. We can basically go on an app on our phone, and somebody's going to pick us up within 10 to 15 minutes and take us where we want to go immediately, and maybe have a full, at worst, a one-hour commute, but in a lot of cases, a 10, 20-minute commute. There is no paratransit like that. And so there are some cities who have gone to that model with a little bit of a higher price, like a Sunband premium type move, and it's been working out pretty well. It takes some pressure off of the routed system. It allows some better service delivery for some of the folks who want to pay a little extra, and that's kind of the pieces that we're trying to fill. And so I think if we can apply some of those principles to the Sunlink side and SunTran side, I think we could have something really special. But it's going to take some time, and I think that everyone is at the table in earnest and trying to find that model that best fits Tucson and gives us the best transit system we can get.
All right, we're going to pause right here. More with Tucson City Councilman Paul Cunningham after we take a break. Buckmaster continuing our midweek edition. More right after this.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane in North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley.
Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary. Home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
This is John Trout. Catch me every weekday morning at 5 before Wake Up Tucson with America in the Morning. Breaking news, weather, politics, and sports on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Make a great getaway, only about a three-hour drive. Spring, terrific time to do some hiking in the Gila National Wilderness. Just a great time to get over to Silver City. Before you get in the car, jump in the van, or hop on the motorcycle, check out their website, southwestnewmexico.org. Great tips on things to do, some terrific places to stay and to dine as well in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. We continue now on our live line, presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management, with Tucson City Councilman Paul Cunningham. I see, Councilman, that Tucson is prepared to leave a lot of water of its CAP drinking water supply in Lake Mead in the next 3 years to help prop up the declining reservoir. Is this a move that you're in favor of?
Well, we've got to do everything we can to preserve the Colorado River. And what's important is in this situation, we get double paper water credits and 1.5 the money back. So for me, it's a no-brainer. We get to be rewarded for basically taking care of our water, and we're still able to maintain all the recharge projects and the other work we're doing. So I think it's a good move for us, and we can claim that water back down the road, which is neat. So I'm definitely in favor of it. I'm definitely in favor in conservation. I'm definitely understanding that the water conservation picture is now a big picture. We graduated from we have graduated from just solving a local water issue with a prominent water supply. And right now we do. We've gone from what some people argue meant as low as a 20-year water supply to a 75, 100-year water supply, depending on who you ask. And if you really want to get down to it, there's things with wet water, water rights, Colorado River rights, future water pieces, what we're saving for the Arizona Water Bank. We've got enough water for a while. And now it's about leveraging that and saying, hey, partners, let's make our whole system statewide, kind of like Tucson's, where we're never going to have to have this discussion again in which we are worried whether or not we will exist 25 to 50 years down the road because we may run out of water. And I think we're kind of the elder statesman in the group. We're the coach. We're the old pro in that group in getting everybody to understand like how we made that work. And a lot of it is really mundane things like, you know, subsidized low faucets and low gallon capacity toilet subsidies and rainwater harvesting ordinances and graduated water rates. These are all things we've been doing for 40, 50 years. And there's legitimately communities in California and across the state going, oh, you can do that? And our answer is, yeah, we can do that. So I think we've got to, including a water service area. We did that too. So all those things have allowed us to get where we are. And now we've got to kind of spread the word on it and just see if we can get everybody lined up. I think if everything goes the way we want it to go, I think we're going to see a very healthy Colorado River in the next decade. We really could. We could get Lake Mead back to maybe not those pre-1990 levels, but, you know, maybe someday at least better than 2016-17 when we were the last years that we actually had some leeway between the Tier 1 shortage and everything. So that's kind of what my hope is.
All right. What about the homelessness crisis? Do you have an update for our listeners? To many, this is the number one issue in Tucson.
So as some people may have heard, my office is doing a day of service every week where we go out to a lot of times an abandoned camp and clean it up and try to help with the backlog on those pieces. I also hired a homeless liaison and a homeless advocate just for my Ward 2 office that goes and visits camps, finds them, and then takes me, and I actually visit with them as well. I'm trying to be as hands-on as I can. A lot of people may not know that 17 years ago I started a movement to fight against teenage homelessness, and my wife works in a social service capacity in placing people a lot of times who are unsheltered. So I've been doing this type of work for 16 or 17 years. And we've tried to be very proactive here on the East Side in meeting people where they are, helping them find placement. The nuances and the pieces are a lot more complicated. You hear all the time, this is a really complicated problem.
Yeah.
Well, oh, gee whiz. But the fact of the matter is we need to break it down a little more than that. We need to talk about who are the folks that don't trust, the don't trusters. That's one of my favorite terms, that they will not trust a social worker. We engage some of the people who are on the street who, you know, it only takes about a month of just lack of sleep and polysubstance abuse and living on the street, kind of afraid of being victimized, where you can see some degree of psychosis in people. It can take as little as 2 weeks and only about a month before there's some level of psychosis. So when you approach a person and say, hey, why don't you take shelter? They're not just going to magically say, sure. You've got to build some rapport and you got to get some trust. And you hear some stories and you hear about them even being victimized in shelter. You hear them, somebody was going to come through for them and didn't, or they relapsed and had some issues as well. I mean, but there's all kinds of different things. But if you don't have any rapport, you're not going to get anything. The other piece is the moment of clarity. And that's for the people out there who have some experience, either some personal experience or some familial experience with addiction. And that is that every addict at some point, in probably every week, at some point has a moment of clarity where they say, oh, gee whiz, I've really got to figure some things out and get it together. But if they don't get any help during that moment of clarity, that moment of clarity passes, and 5 to 6 hours later, they're probably high again. And so we've got to meet them at that moment of clarity. We've got to build those trusts. And when we do, one at a time, we start getting people out of the system. I'll say that the fentanyl crisis has not made it easy. A cheap opiate that's really accessible and easy to hide does not make life easy for anyone. But we've seen this before. We've had new drugs, you know, going back to in the mid-80s when crack became such a big thing. So, again, we've seen this before, and I think we can keep our hands around it, but we've just got to be vigilant and got to be patient. In the meantime, one of the things that helps is if we clean up right away, you don't have an old camp reoccupied. And I think that's a good thing to have. I think it also kind of there's a psychological thing when neighbors are helping neighbors figure that piece out. I think that that's some good feelings and some things. So we're trying to cultivate those things. Our day of service isn't just limited to homelessness. Our Friday days of service, one of the things I'm going to be doing is we're not allowed to use HERF dollars to fill potholes in parking lots. So I'm probably going to do a day of service for that. I'm going to do a day of service for people who want to volunteer. I'm probably do a day of service where I'm going to serve some breakfast at one of the firehouses. So some stuff like that. But that's the day of service that I'm going to do. But you know, we think about all these different things when on how we're built with our norms, our family, our values, our faith, whatever it is, they shape us. And so, you know, I thought it was high time to start using some of those. And so I said every Friday afternoon, instead of making that, you know, the day you try to cut out early because it's the weekend or whatever, my office is going to sponsor a day of service, and anybody who wants to come out and volunteer and just do something that it may not seem like a big deal, but I think it is. And I think it sends the right message. And so that's what we're going to do. We'll be doing another camp, probably cleanup this Friday. And we'll be doing those other days of service throughout.
All right. So if someone sees a camp and it's in your ward, they call your office and your ward will go out and figure out what's going on out there. Is that how it works?
Well, that's one way. The mm-hmm. other thing they can use is the community dashboard, which probably will expedite that process. There's a website that we have that you can go and log in you can log in a case number, you can pinpoint the camp. When we first rolled out the system, you'd get the same camp reported, it would be graded, you'd have a tier one or tier two level, sometimes a tier three or tier four level camp. The more dangerous the camp, the more likely is we're going to expedite its cleanup, depending if there's criminal activity there. So the city homeless protocol dashboard is probably a way to expedite that process, but absolutely we want to be able to go assess a camp as soon as possible, because I want to know where it is and what it's about as the councilman. I should know that as soon as possible. So I try to monitor the homeless protocol dashboard that people use in my ward and see to make sure that the camps that are being reported on the dashboard are also known by our homeless liaison, and we've got somebody who's at least visited them once right away. That way, once that rapport is starting to build, you can start making some progress on whether or not people want to accept services and engage social services. The other piece is that sometimes camps are good camp, a quote unquote good camp. In other words, it's clean and the person isn't bothering anybody or whatever, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's stable. Because all it takes is a bad actor to move into a camp and you can start having some problems.
Yeah.
So we try to monitor that activity as well. Most recently, we had to displace a camp that was in a situation where we're going to be doing some sewage work with the county. And so as a result, there were people living in that wash, and we weren't trying to, you know, quote unquote, run a sweep. We were just letting people know that it's going to be a construction zone. And so they can't camp there. So that's kind of the ways it goes, and we were fortunate enough to have a couple of those people engage services. I think my office has placed 14 or 15 people in shelter since we kind of started this
All right.
really proactive approach.
All right. Paul Cunningham, thank you, Paul. Have a great day.
Bill, thank you. Have a good day.
All right. That'll do it for the Buckmaster Show. On behalf of John and Bill, we hope everybody has a great afternoon.